the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is Lightcast, Episode 2, an interview with Avram Moore of Light Switch Architectural.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Lightcast. Lightcast is produced in partnership with AV Nation. It's a show about light, lighting design, and controlling all of those elements. I'm your host, JP Bedell, along with my co-host, Megan Mazzocco. How are you, Megan? Oh, we lost Megan. In the time that we took us to go live, Megan was just with us, and now she's gone. Hopefully she can jump back in. In the meantime, I will host this conversation with Avi Moore of Light Switch. Avi has been heralded as a future leader by the Illuminating Engineering Society. He is the past president of the Chicago section of the IES. He got his BFA in lighting design from the University of Kansas. He is a directing partner of Light Switch Architectural out of Chicago. He is one of the first and few certified lighting designers out there. We're going to talk about that in our conversation. And I believe that it's safe to say that his work sits right on the nexus of sustainability and beautiful lighting design. Avi, thanks for joining Lightcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is going to be great.
Yeah, I'm excited. And Megan, I see you just jumped back in. This is great. We're all here.
Yes, glad to be here.
Good. So the last time we convened, we talked about TM3015, the new color rendering standard that the IES and Department of Energy jointly rolled out. I guess we're looking at about 6 weeks ago now. Avi, I want to hear from you, man. What are your thoughts on that? We can back up and define it a little bit, and let's talk about what you feel about it.
Well, I'm super excited about it. I think it's really cool. Really excited about coming up with a metric to actually describe color. You know, my favorite joke, I've mentioned her this metric way too many times, but you know how we came up with CRI? We took 10 people into a room. We turn on the light source and say, remember what this looks like. Then you turn it off, turn on the other source. And if 8 out of the 10 people say that's just as good, then you give it an 80 CRI and you don't invite the other 2 people back. I mean, CRI is kind of this really ugly, messy thing, and you know, having a newer metric is really exciting, and I can't wait to see what happens with it.
So the criticism I've heard of this, and I can't claim to be an expert, but the criticism that I've heard is that if you had an 80-plus CRI score on the old scale, you're still going to have an 80-plus score, an 80-ish score on the rendering side of the new metric, but your gamut score is going to be different. Do you think that's legit, or is that just, you know, people cherry picking examples?
I think that there's going to be some manufacturers that are really disappointed by this metric because their product that used to be 80 is now 75 or whatever it may be. And then there's going to be other manufacturers that are super excited by it because it shows that their product's better. You know, honestly, the reality is you're testing between, what is it, you know, and I'm a lighting designer, so I don't think of all the math all the time, but I think we're testing between, like, 12 colors right now, but then the future is, this metric is 99 colors.
Yeah,
whatever you metric by 99 is going to be way better. So, you know, I think the complaint from the manufacturing world is just purely on, well, we've been marketing this way, and now we have to change our marketing.
I think you're getting complaints on the manufacturing side, but I've also heard designers say this is not going to fundamentally change the market, and maybe
I guess I see it, the good.
I don't know.
I see it as something where I can do more in my office to verify the product is going to be good than before getting a sample. I mean, a great example. We're doing a project up north in Chicago. big theater, studio gang called Writers Theater. It's going to be opening in February officially, but we're finishing up the job here pretty soon. Sure, Megan will get some exclusive on that. Mm-hmm. But the front of house is entirely lit with LED. Mm-hmm. I was out there last week, and we ordered some blue step lights. Well, the blue, according to the manufacturer, is actually, in my eyes, teal. But there's no way to really look at that. And I think by looking at the new metric, we're going to be able to get closer to understanding sources matching to one another and being able to understand whether a source can light a material the way that we expect it to. And I think the DOE's presentation really gave that example the best.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that there's, at least in the industry, everyone has an imagination about what the perfect metric would be, you know? And they don't take into account that you've got so many stakeholders that have to agree to this kind of a metric, you know? I heard some people say, like, there's no, you know, this measurement is still flawed because it doesn't take into account color temperature. And some people say, well, you have to keep rendering separate from color temperature. I mean, it's a little bit of this is personal preference or how you choose to evaluate a light source, which is not being taken away by a new metric, you know?
Exactly.
And that's my feeling about it.
It's assisting... Excuse me. It's assisting the lighting designers in making a better metric. It's assisting the lighting designers in picking a source to whatever their hearts desire. I mean, we have museum clients that prefer 3,000, other that can prefer 35, and other ones that prefer 41. You know, and then we have certain installations that prefer higher color rendering, but then other institutions that don't mind an 80, you know, so it really, it's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, and ultimately, it always has been, right? Like, that's the part that I feel like we are losing in this conversation. Like, I did a demonstration back at the last Legication event here in New York where I threw, this is not really about color as much as it is about beam quality, but I threw an MR16 up against the wall next to an LED of a similar sort of output. And, you know, the MR16, which was like the gold standard in terms of light sources for you know, hospitality or residential. And, yeah, the color looked good, but it was a junky beam and weird refractions and, you know, next to a very clean circular LED. And my point being is that there's always been compromises in light sources. That's not new. It's just we're making different compromises with LED.
You know, yeah, and James, I've heard this from a couple of different folks, and I wish I could remember the person I heard it best from. But it's, why with LED are we all of a sudden requesting perfect beam shape, perfect right. color, perfect everything? And I think it's a fair question to ask, but I also say the response to that is, well, we should have been asking for it in the first place, so, you know, what's the difference? The difference here is that we are so much farther along in the technology. We understand optics, and we understand, and we can model optics better than we ever have in any time. So demanding more perfection, I think, is fair, but we have to be mindful that we've never really asked for that kind of perfection back in the day.
Yeah, and I also think that we're also a little bit spoiled by the pace of technological improvement, right? Okay. Like, we saw LED has gotten progressively better and better and better, you know, every 6 months, whereas halogen was a very static technology, right? Like, a new AR-111 would come out with a 6-degree beam spread, and lighting designers would be like, whoa, this is a new thing we have to see and use. You know, LED is changing to the point of, you know, efficacies and color rendering, and all the improvements that happen with LED happen on a cycle that's 6 to 12 months versus 6 to 12 years. So it's a drastically different expectation as far as, you know, adaptation. Megan, I know you're on mute. Do you want to jump in with anything?
No, I was just wanting to go back to the TM30 thing, because I guess we all listened into that DOE webinar, and Avi, you were talking about how, well, yes, of course we want 99 color test sources, because then it helps you to get a more accurate feel for, you know, how this is going to render color in real life. The other part of that TM3015 that I understood is that they're, is it the control source? Half of them are based on incandescent light sources, and half of them are based on natural daylight. And that's something that didn't make sense to me, so I don't know if you have an opinion or an explanation of why they chose to do that.
I would assume that a lot of that is based on the sources that everyone's familiar with. But I have to say, I'm kind of one of those crazy people that really trust if they think that that's the right thing, then okay. I think the challenge in describing color is, you know, what is the reference source you should be using? And I think it's fair to think between incandescent and daylight, because incandescent is the thing that we are also familiar with, and daylight is something else that we're also familiar with. I mean, the classic example with color that I always give is, how many times have you put navy blue socks on, walk into the daylight, and, oh, they're black?
Right.
And we can explain that when using incandescent. We can't explain that when using daylight. And then we can start to apply that to LED. You know, you start to explain to a developer why, you know, this source looks awful. You know, you explain the navy blue thing, and they instantly get it.
Right. You know, and the at the end of the day, you know, I'm curious to see what happens when incandescent is no longer a reputable or a common source, reference source, right? So, like, the incandescent light bulb is phased out for most intents and purposes. Halogen is actually still around. So using a purely incandescent source as a reference source, to me, might not be the best move, because we're not used to the or we won't be as used to the pure warmth of an incandescent. It is going to shade cooler even with a halogen source. So I find that kind of interesting. And the introduction of a daylight source as a secondary reference source is just a vast improvement over how CRI used to work, which was, you know, the incandescent light bulb was perfect and everything else was imitating it.
I apologize. I'm not familiar if some of those reference sources are actually halogen. I don't know. Are you familiar with it, or Megan? I am not sure of that.
Megan, you're muted there.
Right now. Oh, thank you. I'm taking a lighting class right now, and my instructor is actually the one who mentioned that to me, and that he had asked Kevin, I think he was one of the people doing the presentation on the DOE webinar, why it was half incandescent and half daylight for the reference sources, and he didn't have a clear explanation. The thing you were talking about from a lighting designer standpoint, and maybe the manufacturers will go along with this TM3015 kicking and screaming. But on the other hand, don't you think it's creating kind of a market opportunity for the lighting manufacturers to develop some lamps and sources that are favored by this new dual metric?
Well, Avi, I'll let you answer that. Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's the direction. Yeah. The direction. That's what the manufacturers do. A lot of manufacturers, tune their LED for lumen calculation, which my understanding, and I could be wrong, but the lumen calculation is based on having a little bit more green in the source, right? So they pump a little bit more green, and they get a little bit better lumen output. So same thing here. If you want to get a little bit better color, you'll pump to make sure that you get each one of those 99s really amazing. But I would venture to say, and again, I haven't studied every single color swatch, but when I, take that color swatch and put it at a distance, because I'm kind of crazy like that, and look at it, it's really balanced, and I think it'd be pretty hard to tune just to those pixels, and if you did that, you'd pretty much have a pretty well-spectrumed light source.
Right, and you're always balancing between for the manufacturers, what metrics you want to focus on, right? So if you're focusing on brightness, you're going to cheat your metrics a little bit toward that, or your output a little bit toward that. If you want to be known as the good color source, you're going to cheat your metrics for being a little more full spectrum, right? It's about where you want to sit in the market and what you believe is valuable to your customers, right?
I think the amazing thing, though, is those manufacturers that are starting to really pay attention to color tuning and the ability to hit any color mark and intensify color in certain color spaces. And I think, I truly believe that is the future of our industry and those companies and that technology is, I think, where this all is going to go. And this metric really helps us, I think, in that scenario, because it shows how a product could potentially hit on multiple phases and hit a lot of different color points.
Absolutely. Okay, I want to pivot a little bit away from the TM30 discussion, because we could do this all night. And I want to talk a little bit about your work and what you're doing these days. We talked in your intro about the Certified Lighting Designer credit, and I want to talk a little bit about why you sought to go after it, why you think it's important. It's a semi-controversial thing in the industry, and I'm curious to get your take on it.
Well, I guess I got to start with I love controversy in this industry, so of course I had. Let's recall where this all came from. A bunch of people in Texas decided that to do any kind of lighting design in Texas, and this includes production lighting design, you had to be an interior designer or an architect. And LightSwitch is a company across the country that does rock and roll touring and architectural lighting design, really got a red flag from multiple industries saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? And it was great to see the IALD, as well as others, step up and say, okay, we need to do something. And when this all came around, I was really interested and wanted to be involved. And, ultimately, as a certified lighting designer, I'm just excited because it's actually a certification for what I do. We have registered architects, and we have architects that are member of AIA, which I actually sit on the board of AIA here in Chicago. We have the IIDA. We have the Electrical Engineers Association. We have all these different certifications and registrations, but we didn't really have something for lighting, and I was really excited to see IALD put this together and was honored to be one of the first three to get this recognition. As a younger guy, it really means a lot to me. And I think it puts a little bit more, weight behind the lighting design industry. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who practice lighting design, but there's only a handful of people that are certified. There's only a handful of people who are members of IALD and their restrictions. But there's a lot of other people that practice lighting design every day in their homes, as manufacturers, as reps, as distributors, as contractors. And I think, I hope and I pray that this starts to help define the difference between those folks who are doing design, but also the kind of work that we do and our fellow certified lighting designers and IALD lighting designers do.
Yeah, and you know, listen, I came from the lighting design side, right? My current job, I pay the bills as a sales rep, right? There's no question about it. That's what I do day in and day out. But my background is in lighting design. But I do, having been on both sides of that fence, I agree. I think it's important to have a delineation between the two things, because what I do today is very different from what I did, you know, 2.5-3 years ago. No better, no worse, but different. And the biggest difference is that I don't, and I want my clients and every client to understand that, because lighting design is a specific profession. It's like being an architect or a doctor, or you are specialized in something specific. And the less squishy we can make that, and the more realistic and real and sort of concrete for clients, for the rest of the industry, the better. That's just my personal feeling about it.
I wish I could say it as well as you did.
Well, and the other thing too is that, and this is just a little glimpse into how the world works, but you know, we don't think about crossing over specs for structural engineering products. We don't think about crossing over specs for HVAC or other engineered things, because somebody with a lot of letters behind their name put it on a spec, and we respect that. In the lighting industry, specs go out to bid, and the world gets a hold of it, and all of a sudden, a downlight's just a downlight, right? Like, you know.
Right. Well, and everyone's an expert.
Right.
James, I have a theory on this one.
Okay.
If you take a building, and we have 12 residential high-rises that we currently have in different phases of construction or design, and you take that building apart, what are the things that you can actually quantify? I would venture to say toilets, sinks, and all the lighting. The drywall's kind of miscellaneous number, studs are miscellaneous number, cubic feet of concrete, steel rod, all this stuff. And the lighting, you know, being in section 16, is at the bottom.
Right.
It's one of the last things you deal with. Plumbing's pretty high on the list, so is the general conditions and all those things. And it's always a pretty big number. You know, somewhere around $1, 2, 3, 4 million. So it's this nebulous number. And then I would add to it, why can't I just go to Home Depot and buy this?
You know what I think it also is that it's the easiest number in a job, and we're getting into a totally different topic, but I think the other thing that's problematic about it is there are so few experts in lighting that they look at baseline, especially in the LED world, right? So there was a time you could make an argument, like a compact fluorescent downlight is a compact fluorescent downlight, right? Like it's using the same lamp, it's got a similar ballast, you know, the trim finish is going to be pretty much the same. So if I cross it, you know, who's going to really notice? Who's going to really care? That is so inaccurate now. When you talk about LED product and the specificity that goes into every single product and every single metric of the product, but we come from a world of owners who are looking for lowest bids. We're coming from a world of contractors who are trying to save cost. And so they're still kind of treating it as it used to be treated. And that's the biggest, or one of the biggest issues I have with day-to-day business, is trying to explain that I worked with a lighting designer to put this spec together for a reason, and you have to respect it when it goes out in the market, and that's not always the easiest thing to do.
Well, and I guess my beef with the industry is, what are we doing to fix that? What are we doing to correct that?
Right.
What are we doing to correct that? And I would say that...
I was going to...
No, that...
I was going to chime in since I'm in the learning side of the industry, but go ahead and finish what you were going to say, Avi, and then I'll...
No, I was just going to say, what's the industry doing about this? I don't think the industry is doing a good job on this. I wonder if it by doing something about it, it may ultimately affect the manufacturers, and they're ultimately the ones with the most money. So why should we fix it?
You know, my only response to that is you'd be surprised, or at least I have been surprised as I've gotten deeper into the industry, at how little influence on a job basis the manufacturers themselves actually have. They get an order, right? They, 9 times out of 10, unless they've worked on something, you know, a custom with a designer or something like that, they don't really know. They know that they got a quote request, they know they got a bid request, and then the job kind of goes away until they actually get an order placed. It's less about the manufacturers, and it resides more in like the contractor distributor worlds. And those are the folks that we really need to get educated on. These are different products, right? These are not commodity products. And if a lighting designer was hired, odds are the owner wanted needs the approval of that lighting designer before these products go out to the job. That's the relationship we really need to improve.
Yeah, let me throw one more thing out there too, and this is something I use with my clients a lot. Think of the world 30 years ago, right? We bought an incandescent downlight, and let's just use today's pricing because this is what's actually happening. An incandescent downlight is in 3 pieces, a housing, a trim, and a lamp. All in all, today's pricing, you're buying that for maybe $35. Take an LED fixture. It's a housing and a trim. It costs $250. The contractor has to touch it twice, put in the housing, then put in the trim. So the contractor's doing less work. But the percentages to everybody, including the distributors, the reps, everybody involved, is still the same. The fixture got more expensive, but everybody's work involved in it hasn't increased. It's actually decreased, and we're still paying big money. So the whole thing needs a swift kick in the butt. We do what we can on our jobs, and we educate our end owners and clients. But I think for the whole industry to get to the next level, it's got to go everybody, and I agree. It needs to get deeper into the contractors.
Yeah, it's important for everybody to understand it. I think what the core of it to me is the respect and understanding for what the lighting designer does in the process, and the architect for that matter. But right. I can tell you this, you know, the it really depends on your client as well, but a lot of larger clients, especially if they're used to doing commodity buying or if they do multiple sites, they've done this before, they are seeking out competitive bids without talking to their specifiers, right? So they pay a lighting designer a consultation fee to put together a lighting spec, and then they go and they ask their suppliers to cross it. They ask their suppliers to VE it before it's even gotten to out of like the DD phase. They want to know what this is going to cost, and then they want to see what alternates are going to cost. And, you know, I understand your point about the cost of an LED downlight, for argument, for instance, but there's LED downlights and there's LED downlights, right? Like, there's the technology that goes into doing not just a simple dimming fixture, but what are you, if you're talking about a warm glow fixture, something that dims from 3,500K down to 2,200K? What if you're talking about an RGB fixture? What if you're talking about 1% dimming? I mean, all of these things are factors in what that fixture is going to cost. And in my experience, the lighting designer chose a performance-based metric for, you know, the performance metrics of these fixtures for a reason. There was a reason they wanted warm glow dimming, or a reason they wanted dim to 1%. And if you sub that, you're subbing it against the designer's wishes, and ultimately it's going to hurt the project.
Right. My favorite one right now is, oh, well, why can't we just use the 0 to 10?
Right.
Instead of what we always specify, which is Dolly. And I said, you know, my response lately has been, okay, take a look at what the cost of that 0 to 10 volt dimming is. Take a look at what your wiring is. Oh, and also get the price on the control system doing 0 to 10. and then come back to me. 99% of the time, they come back and they're like, oh yeah, Dolly's definitely the option. Because they're only thinking about how much a downlight costs. It's like, no, it's beyond that. It's the whole system. You got to include the controls as well.
Sure. I mean, and every lighting design firm is also going to take a different stance on controls too, and that's another aspect of this. But some lighting design firms we work with, they don't want to touch controls. They don't want to know about controls because they feel like it lands in the engineer's lap, it ends up in operations lap, and they don't want to touch it. Other lighting designers are deeply involved in the control conversation, and they're going to have opinions about it. And so that's just another layer of all this.
Yeah. Yeah. Lighting designers who don't do controls, that'd be interesting.
They give a control parameter. They say, we need the fixtures to be able to do this, this, and this, and we really don't care how you get there. Some do, and, you know, and that it happens. All right, let's talk a little bit about your background and sort of, you know, because I'm interested in how Light Switch treats both theatrical and performance-based lighting and architectural lighting. We share that background. I grew up doing theater and moved into architectural lighting a little later in my career. I'm curious to see if your theatrical work or studying a theatrical work informs your architectural lighting.
Yeah, so Light Switch is 60 people over, you know, our 5 offices in the U.S. and 1 in Hong Kong. Our group actively engages in entertainment and production work as well as the architectural work. If you saw the Spider-Man, our office in New York did all of the video for that.
Cool.
And programming for that. I think Bye Bye Birdie as well. And I think Howard's working on a new production in New York right now. We do a lot of things for different large corporate organizations that we can't talk about, but everybody knows about, kind of a thing. And then on our architectural side, it really does inform it. I actually had a meeting today with a hotel owner, and I said that really we're actually looking to hire people. We want to bring on about 3 more people here in Chicago. And we were talking about where I find those people. And for us, it's really people who have a theater background. Because for us, the number one thing is about the feel of the environment. So we just spent a lot of time talking about the technology. That, to me, is the paint. But you have to come up with the picture first. You have to come up with the idea of what it's going to look like. And our first concentration is it a warm space? Is it a cool space? Is there shadows? Is there not shadows? You know, what does this space really feel like? And then use all the technology that's available to us from all the different manufacturers. And then if somebody doesn't have it, go design it or develop it or whatever we have to do. So for us, we really do take that entertainment approach of what is it going to feel like? What's the look? And then we extend beyond that. You know, as you know, in your past experience in the theater, the set designer and the lighting designer and the costume designer and the director all sit down and basically design the production. And the lighting designer's not sitting in their corner just designing the lighting. They're saying, well, you know, if you use this costume material, that could be really interesting. And the costume designer's coming back and saying, well, I really liked this gel that happened to be on this fabric. And the set designer is talking about integrating light or, you know, we're talking about paint colors. And that doesn't happen as much in the world of architecture. There was this idea of LEED and everybody would talk earlier on, but then we had to build jobs faster. But we have started to push that into our projects to really say, okay, well, what is this material? Could it be this? Could it be this? And taking out materials from our library and saying, hey, you know, let's try this. The other thing we've done a lot is hand samples of products to architects, to interior designers, and say, okay, this is the kind of product we're looking at. Now pick your finishes. And in that scenario, we don't get into the issues of, well, that doesn't look quite right, you know, or especially in our museum work, you know, graphic panels not looking right because we're using a different source of illumination versus what happens to be in their office. So it really does, at least in our practice, we really have engaged the theatrical into the architectural. I will say the biggest challenge for, you know, the theater kids, and I'll never forget one of my mentors, Bob Shook, telling me that the biggest difference between architectural lighting and theatrical lighting is in the architectural world, you better darn make sure that you want that light in that spot.
Mm-hmm.
For the concrete, that fixture is not moving very easily.
That's it.
Yeah. In the theater world, if you want to move that light fixture 6 inches, you just loosen the C-clamp and move it over a little bit.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that's a challenge for you know, that the translation, but I they understand light, and this is a practice about light. It's about designing light, designing with light. The technology is teachable.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment completely. I think the really what I learned, what I took from one practice to the other was the speed of the process. Like, nothing is faster than, or theater is probably the fastest. TV is maybe even faster. I only did a little bit of TV work, but theater, live performance, concerts, that is really, really fast adjustment. And in architecture, speed is, you know, measured in weeks, generally speaking, versus measured in days or hours. And so, to me, that skill set coming from theater, it makes your life in architecture a lot easier. But to your point, being exact in architecture is way more important.
Although, some of the jobs that we're working on right now seem way faster than theater productions.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And then it goes out to bid, and it's slow as molasses for 2 years.
Yeah,
I mean,
right,
Writers
right.
Theater that we've been working on, we started on that job, I feel like in 2007.
Okay, sure.
No, 2007, yeah, probably around, maybe 20, I don't, well, no, that can't be 2007, that doesn't make sense. But I feel like we've been working on it forever, and they're just finally getting to the finish line, but, you know, they're a month out, and it's, you know, fire after fire to get it done. Yeah.
Right. And it's hurry up and wait in the architectural world. It is in theater too sometimes, but it's not to the same scale. And you know, the design windows I feel like are just getting smaller and smaller, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I try to impress upon everybody I work with is the importance of speedy samples. You guys need to have, you know, you need to have the tools in your hands that day because, or as soon as possible, because you don't have 3 weeks to wait for a sample to test something. If that's what you're waiting on, you're going to move on to something that you can get faster. You don't have the time for that kind of stuff.
Speedy samples, but I gotta say, speedy delivery. I mean, I know we had this really terrible economic downturn where factories decided not to keep things on their shelves anymore, but this whole thing about 18 weeks for light fixtures or...
Oh, that's crazy. Crazy talk.
It's just, it's really bad. It's gotten really bad, and I mean, there's a lot of circumstances that make that worse or make that better, but I think that's been a real challenge for us.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling about like delivery lead times is, you know, there's two things to it. One, it can't be a secret, right? Like my biggest issue is when you get like squishy responses on lead time, like, well, you know, when we're not busy, it's like 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 weeks, but when we're like really slammed, it's going to go out to like 16 weeks. Like, no, like tell me what it is, because you know, if you are expecting, like, to a certain extent, if it takes 16 weeks for a factory to build a fixture, and I tell you that, and you're still surprised, then that's on the designer, right? Like, I told you what it was going to be. If that's not acceptable, you know, I understand, but we talked about it. Like, if at the end of the day, you know, they said, well, you know, in a good scenario, it could be 10 or 12 weeks, and that isn't really possible, then it's on the manufacturer. You know, then I have a real problem because, you know, squishy things, people are always going to move toward the faster time if they can get it. So,
well, I also
communication.
I also don't understand how in the architectural industry and especially with manufacturers, they don't get the mantra that we all got in the theater world, which is the show must go on. That does not exist at all once you leave the job site to any manufacturer I've worked with other than some of the theatrical guys. And
I think, explain that a little more. What do you mean?
So we have some products on a job right now that, you know, wired them up, plugged them in, and there's one or two little pieces that aren't working. So, of course, the contractor gets on the horn, hey, you know, seems like this isn't working. We've tested power. Power's there. Fixture's not turning on. The manufacturer 3 days later gets back to them and says, oh, yeah, you know, we can build you a new part. It'll take like 6 to 8 weeks. It's like, no. You don't understand. Like, turn it on. Like, let's go. Right. So after I get involved, it's a, oh, yeah, if you FedEx it to us, we'll take a look at it, we'll fix it, and we'll FedEx it back to you. But you have to pay for all the FedEx. It's like, wait, but this thing is still under warranty. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
So it's those kinds of things that I feel like people don't get. And honestly, the biggest problem I've had in the last 2 weeks was with a major control manufacturer who didn't work on the weekends. And, well, it should work, and they walked out, and it wasn't quite working.
Mm.
And the restaurant opened with a lighting control system that wasn't quite functional.
Right.
You know, so there's just these mentalities that I miss from the theater world. And you can't really embed that in a spec. And
No.
You can't really find out if a manufacturer is going to really meet those requirements until you actually get into that situation.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like anything else, it's about building teams that think are like-minded thinkers and finding teams, and teams are broad, right? It goes from manufacturer to contractor to even to client in some cases, and making sure everyone's on the same sort of wavelength about what kind of a job you like to run and how you expect everybody to respond. And that's important across the board.
Yeah.
All right, well, before we pivot over to our other segment, which is about news and such, I wanted to hear about what you're working on right now that you're excited about, something you can talk about, not one of your secret corporate projects, but something that we can publicly divulge. What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, we're really excited about, we're doing some work down at the Museum of Science and Industry right now. Don't know if you're familiar with the product from Ketra. We've been playing. It's a PAR 38 wireless lamp that does RGB, AW, has integration with DMX, Dolly, 0 to 10. Very, very excited about this technology. We've been using it at the different museums all around Chicago, and actually been using it in our restaurants that we have been doing. So we're working with the Museum of Science and Industry about retrofitting. There are thousands and thousands of lamps down there, and adding controls in spaces that they've never had controls in. So we're really excited about that. And also, those in Chicago are coming to Chicago soon. We just opened Swift & Sons, a new restaurant with the Boca Group. A fantastic steak restaurant. Brought my grandpa there a couple weeks ago, 93 years old, said it was the best steak he's ever had in his life.
Nice.
It was pretty good, too. So really excited about that, and we have some future projects coming with Boca, a new restaurant opening in January, and another one coming in March. Very excited about that. I'm really excited for Writers Theater to open. It's been a long project coming. The stage lighting is incandescent. That was done by the great AFP in New York. All the house lighting, architectural lighting is done by Light Switch, the Architect Studio Gang. All the architectural lighting is LED, controlled via DMX. There is no dimming panels. Everything is done with digital controls. And very excited for this project to get opened very, very soon and, you know, be all over all the trades and win major awards, we hope.
Excellent. That's great. I love all that. If people want to, so we're going to jump over to Lighting Vitals, which is our sort of news you can use segment. Megan's going to take that over. Do you want to stick around and share your two cents on these points as they come up, or you got to?
Sure, I'll stick around.
All right, awesome. Megan, I'm going to hand it over to you. Talk about what stuff we should know.
Okay, great. Well, the first thing that I wanted to mention is kind of a local flavor, and that is the Illuminations production that Light Switch Architectural puts on at the Morton Arboretum in Lisle, Illinois. And that is, I think, getting back to more of the theatrical side of the practice, if I don't get you wrong. And then in terms of more of a newsy and product
and Megan, thanks for mentioning it. How dare I not mention Jenkins? Everybody's got to come out. It's at Morton Arboretum, the most amazing lighting show ever created. It'll be all new again. Our whole team is already starting this session, and it opens right before. Come on out.
We are already planning on it. We're just finding a good weekend in November to hopefully get there before it gets too cold. Although I always think, I also hail it as a very good active design, especially for people in the suburbs, because you actually get out and walk, more or less a mile in the cold. But it's highly entertaining and it's beautiful for all ages. So yes, we're very excited and very looking forward to that. So anyone who's listening in the Chicago area, please make the journey, make the trek. It is so worth it. Product from a product standpoint, some news that caught my eye in the last 30 days is Lunera came out with a new thermoplastic heat sink for their Helen lamp, and that kind of, made my head turn because I was like, well, wait, what about, aluminum, and can a thermoplastic heat sink really work in application? I don't know. And what about recyclability? Any thoughts on that?
The thermoplastic thing, no other manufacturers are playing around with it. I know that it's been something that they've tried. I'm curious to see what that's going to do for the Helen lamp in terms of its, so the Helen lamp had an Energy Star listing, and then the Energy Star listing was taken away. I'm curious to see if they went in this direction to either reduce cost or to improve efficiency. I'm not sure how it would improve efficiency. I'm not a thermal engineer, but I am curious to see if maybe the thermal plastic is just easier to work with, faster to manufacture, takes the metal cost out of the lamp, which is, I know, a big... we're getting to this point now where the LEDs are the least expensive part of a given light source, right? Because they're mass-produced chips. Rolling steel, rolling aluminum, pressing these metals are really the more expensive part of any of these fixtures, or getting there. And those are fixed costs that I'm sure the manufacturers are trying to get rid of.
Thank you for your thoughts on that, JP. The other thing that caught my eye was that Osram was touting their straight filament LED that's entirely illuminated in hopes that it will bring about a better imitation of a conventional Edison bulb. I've seen some really, I guess, neat or cool renditions already of a traditional Edison bulb, so I'm not quite sure how this one will be differentiated. But have you guys had any experience with the straight filaments or the LEDs that are hoping to imitate the conventional Edison bulbs?
Well, I'm sure you guys get the same calls that I do from your clients. Oh my God, I love these bulbs. They're so it's incandescent, you know, is there an LED solution? And you say, well, I haven't seen one that's actually NRTL listed, right?
Right.
And then they go on Amazon, and I had a client do that this week, said, oh, I just saw these really cool lamps, you know, can I use these? What do you think? And, you know, I'm an Amazon Prime member, so what the heck? I figured I'll order a few and see what it looks like. Get them into the house, screw them in, no label whatsoever. No UL, no ETL, no CSA, no nothing on the box. Take the lamp out of the box, there is literally not a shred of labeling anywhere on the lamp whatsoever. It doesn't tell you wattage, doesn't tell you UL, ETL, it doesn't say anything. You know, and you just kind of brush that aside because, yeah, it's a Chinese thingy. Screw it in. I am very susceptible to flicker. I have never seen something with such terrible flicker in my life. 60 hertz and you know, Chicago has some of the worst electricity. ComEd, you know, doesn't really have to produce anything really great. This was really bad. I mean, solid 60 hertz, probably a little bit worse. Crazy flicker. I was showing my fiance, because every place I walk into, I swing my hand like Naomi Miller. She talked, you know, and now I was doing that with this, and I showed her, and she finally understands what I mean about flicker.
So I don't have as bad an I can't speak to this specific product because I haven't seen it or worked with it, but I haven't had that kind of negative experience. I've seen the Mega Man filament lamps, you know, Mega Man contact lamps. I've seen the Satco lamps. I actually saw both today. I have two sort of things about this product in general, and I'm curious about your opinion on this. One is philosophical, right? One is, why do we continue to ask LED to mimic things that it's not, right? Versus innovating new things for it to be, right? So LED can functionally fit into form factors that incandescent, fluorescent, metal halide, name the source, could never physically do. And yet, we are fixated on making LED fit into classic form factors that it was never designed to actually do, right? Like, which I philosophically just, like, I can't handle. I don't understand why that's the state of the industry, but that's my philosophical point. The technical point is, everyone kind of does this, you know, some do it a little bit better than others. I mean, these are UL-approved lamps, they're labeled, they're listed, you know, we get over that hurdle. But you're not going to get the same feel out of one of these lamps as long as there's a driver base on this thing that is, you know, half an inch and fills up half the lamp. You're just not going to get the same feeling. It feels like a technical piece of equipment and not like a glowing incandescent, you know, filament. And to me, no matter how well the engineers manage to mimic filament in LED, as long as you have to have that little... that, you know, that driver compartment at the from between the socket and the filament, it's always going to feel different, and I don't know why we're chasing this thing so hard.
JP, okay, I love it. Thank you. I love it. Thank you. So when Rachel and I were in Murano, we bought a gorgeous Murano chandelier.
Right.
And wow, it came in 25 different pieces, and holy cow, it's heavy.
Right.
But it's got candelabra bases. And, of course, I'm like, what can I do to put into it? There's nothing to put into it. Yeah, it has this ugly-ass base, and there's no way I'm going to put that in that chandelier.
Right.
It drives me nuts that people do this in their homes and do this in places. I couldn't agree with you more. The funny thing is, though, the lamps that I got from Amazon, they don't have a base. I mean, it's medium base and glass all the way up.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Probably why there's all the flicker, because 120 straight in and maybe a little chip transformer or whatever.
Right. They've got no hardware in there.
You know, on your other point of, you know, why do we keep shoving LED into the standard, you know, sizes? If you look at the NGL, the Next Generation Luminaires report for the last 6 years, I think we've been doing that, that I've been involved in it. Every year we say the same thing. Where is the innovation?
Right.
And I think part of it goes back to what we talked about earlier. Where's the equal?
Right.
You know, everybody wants something equal. Everybody wants, I think there's a number of manufacturers, maybe the big guys, I don't know that end of the industry as well as I wish I did, and maybe I just don't want to, but what can I have contractors stock on their shelves?
Right.
Because that's going to meet my bottom line this month. And downlights and lay-ins and all those things are things that they'll hold. So let's keep making that stuff.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, cool. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I just think it's twofold. It's what can we stock, because this is what people are asking for. And then, you know, there's just no innovation because nobody wants to put the money behind it. It costs too much.
I completely agree. I mean, my one of my biggest pet peeves on the consumer side, now this isn't really spec grade lighting, but I think the mentality carries over, is like we spent the last maybe 18 months, 2 years, really after the Philips Hue lamp came out, the Wi-Fi RGB lamp, all these other lamp manufacturers decided that now they needed a smart light bulb, right? Something that connected to Wi-Fi, something that did this, that, and the third, and all the toy stuff that can connect to an app. This, to me, is not the innovation that we need first, right? What we need, if you really, really want to make an LED A lamp, make a beautiful LED A lamp. Like, make one that is an exquisite thing to look at, and then you can throw Wi-Fi in it. Then you can make it connected to the grid. Then you can do whatever else you want to do with it. But make it gorgeous first. Like, if you're going to spend R&D dollars, I want it to be exceptional as a piece of lighting first, right? And that mentality, I think, goes into this other stuff, right? So it's not about, like, you're replacing a 2x2 troffer, so who can make the thinnest 2x2 troffer? Like, who cares? It's still a 2x2 square in the ceiling, right? Like, it's great that you can make it thinner, and that's exciting and all, I guess, but in reality, you're not revolutionizing lighting, you're just making a thinner panel. And, you know, I had a manufacturer who I don't work with come up to me at a trade show today and say, our next generation flat panel is going to be thinner than an iPhone. Awesome. It's still a 2x2, a 2x4, a 1x4. It's still going in the same hole in the ceiling. So at the end of the day, these are the metrics we need to care about, you know?
Does that mean it's cheaper and that I can get it faster and it has dolly controls? Okay, then I might be interested, but I really don't care that it's thinner.
Right. I mean, you know, this is just these are the things that you know, drive me crazy, but...
Yeah,
I don't work in that side of the industry. But Megan, do we have more news to talk about, or are we going to wrap this bad boy up?
That is the end of the news. But I had a thought on, you know, why we are trying to shove the LED into the incandescent package. It's the same reason why they're still making rotary style looking phones, the same reason why they have iPod docks that look like old fifth time radios. It's kind of, you know, it's almost like that theatrical idea of, you know, set design or nostalgia, or how do you want to feel in your space, and for some people that's what they identify with. And then the other thing we were talking about a while back is, what is the, you know, what is the industry doing about, you know, changing the situation of why is lighting, you know, Section 16 on the list? Why is that one of the last things? I mean, from my perspective, in the big picture of being in the architectural industry and talking about, you know, products and engineering and net zero buildings, for me, the big picture is, you know, first architecture and then engineering and then health in the space. And for the user, that includes product transparency and then, you know, indoor air quality, which is kind of another part that's hinging on engineering, but then lighting. I mean, lighting, I think, should be, and people need to realize that yeah, that does affect your user health and your user performance in the space. It should be the third thing you think about. And from somebody who's in interior design school, finishing interior design school, it seems like very strange to me that there's actually only one lighting class that you are required to take the entire program. And then there is a daylighting class that's offered as an elective, which I plan to take. And in class, it does seem to me that yes, you need to have a strong lighting designer, and there's not enough of them out there. There's not enough of them that can, you know, I guess, wrangle the contractor and say, no, you can't buy the cheap one. You have to...
Get them my way. I'll point them in the right direction.
Right. So I think with the certified lighting designer certification program, and also I'm hoping they're going to introduce, if it's not already in the works, a certified day lighting designer program. I really think that through education and hopefully not only interior design but architecture and engineering, that we can get some strong lighting designers on the docket to really put lighting where it belongs on the list. So that was my thoughts on the big picture of how to get change happening here in the industry. And then I had a couple little questions about adventures in lighting, if you guys are up for some, I guess, current events or consumer questions.
So our producer, Tim, is telling me that we are gone over our time.
Oh.
So I don't want to cut everybody off, but I think we've been on for a little bit over an hour now.
Okay.
So past prime.
I'll save
time.
It for next time.
There you go.
It's applicable.
All right. Avi, thank you so much for joining us here on Lightcast.
Thanks, Avi.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, right?
All right. So, this is my time to do the closing. Lightcast is a co-production of, well, not a co-production, it's produced in association with AVNation TV. You can find more at AVNation.net, or .tv, sorry. Wow, it's getting late. AVNation.tv. I'm sorry I'm screwing this up so bad, AVNation. Thank you very much to Avi Moore for joining us. Thanks to my co-host, Megan. And we will talk to you soon. And that's it. #Lightcast. Bye.